Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're getting cheesy today.
We are. Yes. Cheese, please, right? Cheese, please.
Cheese, please. Yes, it's become a big thing. It's not just plopping a hunk of cheese on a tray, but to do all the accompaniments and dress it all up.
Yeah.
We did one book about the cheese plate, and now we have a second one by Tia Keenan called The Art of the Cheese Plate. And it's very artful and the wonderful recipes.
Well, I just met Tia Keenan, and I really wish I'd met her a long time ago because she's such a delightful and informed person on the subject of cheese and composing the cheese plate. We're going to be talking about her book, The Art of the Cheese Plate, and it covers everything, pairings, recipe, style, attitude. I like that one, Tia. What are you envisioning as attitude?
Oh, well, I think the book definitely has its own sensibility, which is kind of a nicer way of saying attitude.
It has a lot of attitude.
Yeah.
And a good sprinkling of wit. Lots of wit.
I encourage the reader to really embrace their own expression and attitude when they're serving cheese, that it can be something, it can be a sort of conduit for expressing a point of view on entertaining and on eating, and that it doesn't need to be something staid, that it can be something that's really celebratory and, like, fun and a showcase for your point of view.
Well, I think you get all that across. One lovely book. Rizzoli did a great production job on it, too. And the photography is heavenly.
The photography was done by Noah, and the styling by Reclaim Design New York, and Rizzoli certainly, editor John O'Jarrett, and Rizzoli certainly knows how to make a pretty book.
Let's talk about organization, because I was getting a little lost in how it's all organized. Now, how many cheeses do you cover?
So I cover about 114 cheeses.
Right.
And now, from my perspective, that's not that much.
Right. But there used to be only two in the supermarket.
What two were those?
You could get orange American cheese, or you could get white American cheese.
Sure.
And the only time I ever shopped for those two cheeses was for our grandchildren, because it's the only kind of cheese they would like. But I come from a place where cheese has a tradition of a few more centuries than here. Sure. But the U.S. is certainly playing catch-up.
Well, you're talking about U.S. I mean, globally, she selected cheeses from around the world, right?
Yeah, I have an international selection of cheeses in the book. American cheeses are definitely represented, though I don't have yellow American cheese or white American cheese.
What a relief.
But I had, so the book is 114 cheeses. The general organization of the book is that I offer, I think it's 37 different composed cheese plates. Most of them are cheese plates comprised of three cheeses with two original condiment recipes and one purchased condiment. And then there's a couple of wild card entries that focus on one cheese.
Yeah, I like your terminology throughout this book. I mean, you can tell that you're a thinking writer, like impactful accompaniments. I love that.
Well, I mean, I think the most, it's really nice when something you eat is not just delicious in the moment, but also memorable.
Well, I find people passionate about cheese in the most unlikely places, people I hardly know from the gym. All you do is mention cheese and they go into all kinds of throes of ecstasy about the possibilities.
Yeah, it really is something that inspires passionate devotion.
Well, now you outline some characteristics here. You do types of cheese. And that you break down, and I mean, it's sort of a it's not just your usual categories in a way. You do fresh, surface ripened, pasta filata, semi-firm, firm hard, firm and hard, and then you do blue. That's the types, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you move on and you do foundational flavors, and from there you also do foundational textures. Could you explain what is a foundational flavor and what is a foundational texture?
Sure. Well, I wanted to talk about cheese in this way because I felt like it was a really consumer-friendly way to talk about cheese. I didn't want to be too technical, so the ways that I choose to categorize cheese in this book are a combination of technical and more consumer-friendly or tactile experience.
This is not Max McCollum's primer on cheese.
No, I wanted this to be really readable, and right. Not that Max's isn't. We all love Max.
And yeah, we do.
He's a personal friend, and his books are wonderful. But I wanted this to be something that was not intimidating and to really reach a lot of different types of people, whether they're people who have a fair amount of knowledge about cheese or people who just know that they like eating it but don't know that much more about it. So I talk about the different textures and different flavors that are common across categories of cheese. And I did that because this being a book about pairings and making cheese plates, it's really important that people start to think about flavors and how flavors interact and how flavors are connected across different cheeses. And I also wanted to play around a little bit because I think that one of the things that's hard for American people is to talk about the experience of food. The experience of eating it, what flavor is, how to use words to talk about that. It's flavors hard to talk about for everyone, but I think especially for American people because we have because we're such a young country, because we don't have just one food culture, we have many different food cultures, that I wanted to sort of begin to give language to flavor.
How did you get involved with cheese?
You know, honestly, I think a lot of it was luck, and maybe the smartest thing I ever did was that I just became interested in cheese right before everyone else did. So when people started really becoming interested in cheese, I was already a couple steps ahead of the game and there to sort of be able to make a career out of that. But I started working in restaurants and in fine dining restaurants in New York. It used to be that the pastry chef would organize a cheese course, if there was a cheese course. And then it was the waiter's job to explain those cheeses to the table. And, of course, all the waiters were always getting in trouble for not knowing anything about the cheeses. And so I learned about some of the cheeses that we were serving at a restaurant where I was working. And then in the next restaurant, a manager would say, oh, does anyone know anything about cheese? And I would raise my hand. I would say, oh, I know a little bit about cheese. And I sort of started accumulating knowledge from there. And then I got my first big break when I was on the opening team for Danny Meyer's The Modern at the Museum of Modern Art, and I was the chef fromage there, and it was an incredible experience and a white glove.
Yeah, who was the chef? Who was it there?
Gabriel Kreuter, yeah. And the pastry chef was the incredibly talented Marc Aumont, and so I ran the cheese program out of that beautiful dining room.
We know it well.
Sculpture garden. And it was an incredible experience to work for Danny and to work with that team and to work in the Museum of Modern Art. And so that's when I realized, oh, like this is my thing.
Uh-huh.
This is what I do.
Right.
I work with cheese.
So you've been doing it ever since?
And so I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, what is it with suddenly, yours is the second book that we've received on the cheese plate in a matter of a couple of months. Is there some kind of renewed interest or a reason for this? I mean, the first book we interviewed, what's the name of it?
Brian Keyser from?
Yeah, Brian Keyser.
Yeah, we actually worked together, Brian and I. We opened Casalula together.
Oh, you did?
Okay.
You know that his co-writer then, the pastry chef?
I do. She was hired by me Yeah.
But why is it then that all of a sudden everybody's interested in the cheese plate?
I just think that we're at a real turning point in American culture where artisan cheese has become much more mainstream. I was just talking with one of my editors today that the largest retailer of specialty cheese is Costco. They're selling a massive amount of imported European cheeses, and American artisan and you know, medium and large scale production.
Wow.
And so I think just so many more American people have high quality cheese in their hands, and they're looking for ways to serve it. I mean, when I started working in cheese, the only place that you could get a cheese plate was in a fine dining restaurant.
Right.
And 15 years later, you can get a cheese on a broad range of menus. Everything from fine dining to wine bars to more sort of casual new American places to your airport, you know, to an airport. I mean, they have cheese plates in airports now. And it used to be that you'd have to, you know, spend $500 on a meal to get a cheese plate at the end of it. And
wow,
that's where you got a cheese plate. So times have just changed, and I think people are looking for ways to work with cheese in their own homes.
Okay, so this is meant for somebody, a home, I don't want to say cook, but a home entertainer
to put this together.
That's what this book is for.
Absolutely, 100%. And the cheeses that I chose these cheeses specifically because I felt like most of them would be available to the average consumer. So I looked at the cheese cases at Costco. I looked at the cheese cases at Wegmans. I looked at the cheese cases at Kroger. I looked at the cheese cases at Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, this is where my reader is going to buy their cheeses. And so those are the cheeses that I put in the book. Of course, being someone who's passionate about cheese, I had to put some cheeses that are maybe harder to find, but I have a guide in the back that tells you where to find stuff, and so for those cheeses, I include information on how to get them. I mean, the amazing thing is now, with the internet, you can order a lot of cheeses and have them mailed to you, so it's just a different world than it was when I started.
Now, of course, you have to take out a second mortgage on your house if you want any rogue creamery.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not, it's,
not cheap. Not cheap,
yeah,
cheap.
It's not cheap.
No, sure. Well, that's, of course, my next word was basically you can find cheese plates all over the place now, but they're not all created equal.
No, I mean, I think a lot, I think there's a long, there's, we have a long road, to developing that aspect of the culture, the sort of stewardship and care of cheese and the serving of cheese.
Yes, I mean, like the airline's cheese plate is not one I would seek out.
Let's pick one. Let's pick one that seems in a way like a kind of an odd combination, but all three cheeses are cheeses that Anne and Peter are very familiar with. And with one exception, I think that probably other people will be familiar with them too. And then let's talk about why you chose to put them together.
Yeah, because you put your reasons very lucidly readers.
But let's have you explain it on air. So the one I'm picking is one that's close to the end. It has mozzarella from Campania.
Oh yeah.
It has Stilton, which is the real Stilton. not the phony Stilton that now their regulators make them make. And then an out of the blue one, if you tried to explain to people around the world that the best raw milk, cow's milk cheese made in the world practically probably comes from Wisconsin. and people are wearing it on their heads. I'm talking about Uplands.
Oh, I love Uplands.
So there you've got three wonderful cheeses, each of which to me seems rather different. So why put them together?
Sure. So we are talking now about entry in my book called Flight of Fancy, which is an entry of three cheeses: a mozzarella di bufala Campagna, the Uplands Cheese Company Pleasant Ridge Reserve Extra Age, and Stitchelton. And I put this flight together really as a flight. This is a flight for a special occasion, to celebrate something wonderful or a special holiday. I chose these cheeses because they, to me, are very special cheeses, but also the accompaniments that I serve with them are very special. So there's truffles with the mozzarella di bufala Campagna. There's jamón ibérico with the Pleasant Ridge Reserve Extra Age. There's a dulce chocolate cane Stichelton. So I chose these as a range because they are all very different. That's actually a lovely way to compose a cheese plate, because then you're giving the person who's eating a really well-rounded sensory experience. You're giving them lots of contrast in flavor. You're giving lots of contrast in color. You're giving lots of contrast in texture. And so in that way, I think it's a nice arc. I like a cheese plate to tell a story. That story, to me, it's important that that story first comes in an arc of flavors and textures. And then I also love a story of the way that cheeses relate to each other, a sort of ethnography of cheeses, which I think I try to do.
Well, how about with that particular pairing? What's the relationship?
Well, the relationship is that these are all really special, unique cheeses that are rare or precious in another way. So mozzarella di bufala Campagna is a mozzarella that stands apart from all others. It's also, if you're eating that in America, you're eating a cheese which was produced one day and then put on an airplane the next day and then distributed to your store. You're eating a fresh cheese that's come from Italy. I want people to recognize that that's an actually like incredibly luxurious experience to be able to do that. I think sometimes we take for granted the way that goods move around the planet. I wanted to pause and get people to understand you're eating a very fresh cheese from the other side of the world. You know, that is a special experience for a special occasion. And then of course served with truffles. Just on a personal taste level, I want truffles on a very clean canvas. I don't want them piled over lots of other flavors. And I think mozzarella di bufala Campagna has an incredible, creamy, cloudy texture that something could be so rich but also so seemingly light. And then is a perfect foil for this like earthy umami truffle. And then we have the Uplands Pleasant Ridge Reserve Extra Aged, which is a almost 2-year-old cheese, you know. So that, I want people to be cognizant that you're eating something that has been tended to for years in order to make it to your plate. That's something really special. That luxury isn't just about money or conspicuous consumption, that luxury is also about time. And that increasingly in our world, time is luxury. And so eating a beautifully made aged cheese is a very luxurious experience. And then I pair that with the jamon ibérico, which is, of course, one of the great hams of the world and quite pricey, actually. And so you have this combination of fat and fat. You have this the jamon ibérico, which is this, like, silky, melt-in-your-mouth. And then you have the butter fat of the cheese, which is like this hard, sort of crystallized, very dense fat. And I love that image of luxury of like layers of fat being what luxury is. And then finally the Stilton, which is what Stilton used to be before it sort of became taken over by industrial production. And so Stilton is a raw milk blue cheese made in the style of Stilton, the way that Stilton was made 100 years ago. And so there's luxury in that. There's luxury in slow food, right? And food that carries traditions in the food ways of our ancestors. That is luxury. And then I serve that with a Dulce Champagne Ganache, Dulce chocolate is basically like a toasted white chocolate. And so just this very luxurious, rich, creamy, smooth accompaniment. So I really went for it in this flight explore all the ways that one could explore the concept of luxury and cheese.
This is called how quickly can you put $100 on a cheese plate?
Well, you know, there's that too.
I wanted to finish up on the subject of cheese with an experience that I hope you shared with us, but perhaps you haven't. I'm projecting us to the Borough Market in South London, where there's on a side street from the market is Neil's Yard cheese shop.
Yep.
Filled with gigantic wheels of cheddar and Colton and Bass's Stilton. And mm-hmm. I can smell it now. Mm. Have you been there?
It's funny because I have a flight of British cheeses in the book, and there, I believe, all of them are from Neil's Yard Dairy.
Yeah, well, that's where to go. You know, listeners, I said before that she was a very accomplished and smart writer, but I'll tell you, T, I think you must have had more fun naming these things. You gave them all names. And I eat your idols, utter from another mother. What is your favorite that you really came up with? It was, you thought, that's it.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I went through titles so much. I've just always originally started naming flights with sort of whimsical names because it, in restaurants when I was writing menus, because it can often feel very intimidating. And so I found that writing menus and naming flights of cheese with whimsy was a way to sort of break down the intimidation factor for my guests in the restaurant. And so I figured that if it worked in person, that it would probably work on the page in a book.
Well,
this
whole book works. Listeners, again, the very talented and knowledgeable author is Tia Keenan. And the title is The Art of the Cheese Plate. And it's, you have to be inspired by this book, Tia, I think, to do something besides slap a few cheeses on a tray.
Thank you so much. It's
yeah,
really
and
kind
good
of
luck
you.
With it. And it's good meeting you.
It's really nice to meet you, and thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Thanks, Tia.
And, of course, while we're on the subject of cheese, which will be right after the break again, we should remember not only that you should design your cheese plate, but somebody has to make the wonderful cheese in the first place. And we caught up with one of those from the unlikely cheese-producing state of Indiana in the good old US of A, and we'll be bringing him to you right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. As Peter indicated, from time to time, we like to bring you exceptional cheeses that we've discovered. And boy, this one is a Lulu. We're going to be talking to Matthew Richford, whose southeastern Indiana farm produces knockout farmstead, artisanal farmstead cheese.
And the amazing thing is the farm's been in the same family since the early 1800s.
Yeah.
But they only started making cheese about 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, so he's going to talk to us about the farm, his family history, his products, and his award-winning cheeses.
Who knew that the Richford family had been farming in southeastern Indiana since the early 1800s? Must feel kind of important. Matthew, yes?
Yes, it is the Hamiltons and the Elliots. It was my mother's family that were here. The Elliots were the ones that came the first, and then the Hamiltons and the Handleys, and it was my mother's side of the family.
And then Mr. Richford must have crept in there somewhere.
Yes, that's my father. He was raised in northeastern Ohio, and met my mom at school. Up in Wisconsin.
Okay. And now who's Jacobs? Because what we're talking about...
That's my wife, Leslie Jacobs. Okay. And all of our children have hyphenated last names.
Okay. And, now, was she a farmer too?
No. Her father was a car dealer in Chicago. And I was living in Urbana, Illinois, where my father is a historian. He was the archivist at the University of Illinois.
Happy daughter.
And Leslie came to school and went down there, and we met when she was living in Urbana.
So, what directed you to farming then?
I always wanted to farm. Ever since I was a little kid, I spent a lot of time here on the farm with my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
Always my hero when I was a kid, and that's pretty much what I always wanted to do.
It's hard. I mean, I told you about my great uncle's dairy farm. He didn't have a life. It was all the farm, especially it was.
Well, it is a lifestyle. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle, and there's times when it's been a lot more trying than others, you know, some of that is why we chose to start making cheese rather than bumping along in the marginally profitable fluid milk business.
Right. So the whole milk business is really pretty tough.
It seemed like for us it was like one good year out of three, and the others just didn't make up for it. You know, it didn't make up for it. So,
right. When did the switch over to saying, well, we can get a little more value out if we make cheese? How recently?
Well, I was always aware of that. I started with rotational grazing and, you know, intensive pasture management in the late 80s and was aware that dairying is probably a more profitable way to market that grass, and had always had that in the back of my mind. And so we switched that. We built our we opened our dairy parlor in 95, and at the time we were considering making cheese, but we had a lot to learn about the dairy business before we did that. So that's where we started, and it just took us a while.
When you say you learned about...
But I did a lot of research in that time and went to a couple of short course on cheese making, and went to France and visited cheesemakers there. And
well, that's
we
a good place to go.
Mm-hmm.
We use
French
cows. You have French cows.
Yeah, we use French. Well, they're Indiana cows, but we use French genetics. And we started off with a Jersey base because they're a good grass breed, and for we have hot summers here in southern Indiana. And then we crossed Normandies into them to give them a little more size, and then as we got closer to cheese making, we bred in the Tarentaise. And so we always use purebred sires and generally try and breed towards whatever a cow doesn't have. You know, if she looks Tarentaise, we'll breed her to a Normandy. And it's not a terribly scientific program, but we have had pretty good results with the type of cows we're breeding. And
it's complicated.
I think our genetics really affects the taste of the cheese.
Oh, of course. And, you know, we had this go around with somebody who was helping with this Wagyu stuff in Texas. And they were having, how did it go? I think the Wagyus.
A lousy mothers.
Were lousy mothers. And, but the
Angus.
Angus were good mothers. But everybody wanted the Wagyu beef. So what they did was they would inseminate. Right, and then they would transplant the fetus.
They actually transplanted the fetus into mother cows, which were the Black Angus. I guess the female Wagyus were out of business.
I don't know. It seems like it might almost be easier just to market the Angus there.
I think that's what I would think too. Now, let's get a
clarify. They're pretty good eating. I know that.
Yeah, I know. And how about, just for our listeners, a definition, just a reminder of the definition of farmstead, because the cheese is Jacobs and Bridgeford farmstead cheese. And that's very important. Could you explain that?
Farmstead means that they are all our own cows.
Right.
And that we are both the farmers and the cheesemakers.
Right.
And so that the milk is produced on the farm, and it is our, you know, it is our sole source of milk. And
your cows are grass-fed.
100%.
See, that's really important.
Now, what do you feed them hay?
I guess that's not absolutely true. We do supplement with molasses sometime when the grass is too washy and they need some extra energy. The whole thing about the health aspects of grass fed is that they get a non-grain source of carbohydrates, that's what affects it. So there are some things that you can supplement with, like beet pulp and citrus pulp and things like that, that can give them be a carbohydrate source it's not grain, and it would still give you the omega-3s that you're wanting and all that. But we don't mess with that much. We're 100% grass fed, and so when I started my dairy, I was always a grass-based dairy, but we fed a little grain as well, considerably less than what a normal dairy would. And I discovered that it's a crutch. It makes you a less efficient grazer, and it makes your cows less efficient grazers. And
that's interesting.
So getting rid of the grain really helped us a lot.
Yeah, he's doing the rotational grazing with his cows. Like we have,
like Jamison Farms with their lamb.
We have a friend who's in the lamb business, and he uses the French style rotational grazing for his lambs. And he's pretty unique in doing that at all. I mean, almost nobody does it the same way in the lamb business. In the cow business, I guess it's a little different.
Not me. How many?
Well, you have to think about it when you're inviting somebody over to dinner, and here's your salad bar, and you know, except this is what you get for dinner tonight, and it looks great, but you're going to spend the night on that, and then you're going to walk around on it all day tomorrow, and then that's what you're going to have for dinner the next day. So when you move cattle more often, they become what they're being moved to is their good fresh pasture, and they really appreciate that. And
I understand that. Matt, I understand they're pretty smart, and they will actually pick out particular blades of grass they particularly like. Is that right?
Yeah. Although, if you're implementing what I was just saying, you know, they're hungry and they're moving into something, and you want to try and make sure that what they're getting is everything they want, and so, you know, to that end, you know, what you've got out in your pastures is pretty important, and we do a lot of work with raising annuals to supplement our perennial grasses through the season, so we've always got something we can balance out our regular pastures with.
Well, you have a lot to learn about this, and don't even, you have a lot to learn, have a lot to learn about the cheese making process, and here you are. We first heard about you because you started winning all these awards. Now, I mean, that's kind of amazing, isn't it? Aren't you amazed?
Yeah, I guess a little bit. We got in the business to be successful, and so we've just been working on that.
Now, how many kinds of cheese do you produce?
We have 7 different labels now.
Okay. And, can you just briefly run through the profiles you're aiming for?
Well, we were talking about all the different cheeses and how Andy only has to make one, is that, we've been trying different things to find out where the market is and what they're gonna buy. And so when I started out, I wanted to make a Gruyere and Camembert. And I worked with a consultant, Neville McNaughton, and we kicked a lot of things around and decided that it would be too tough to make a raw milk, and I wanted to remain raw milk, and it would be too tough to make a raw milk Camembert, having to age it for 60 days. So,
yeah,
and so we came up with Everton, our Gruyere style.
Which we really liked a lot.
Thank you. And then we made Brianna, which is a washed curd cheese similar to a Fontina.
We like that, too. That's a
surprise. So it's a medium age. The Everton, we let it go to about 8 months at least, and the Brianna goes out around 90 days, and then wanted something shorter term, so we have our Mirabella, which is a wash drying cheese that's it's ready at 60 days. We can sell it at 60 days, and it's although it gets a lot stronger, and I like it with a little more age on it, but
that's a prize winner too, isn't it?
Yes, the Everton and the Mirabella have both won Good Food Awards, and we're always trying. We're not selling everything we make, so we're looking for what it takes to hit the market. And I always liked Reblochon when I was in France, and
You make one like that. I love that. That was the first one I finished.
Our Adair, and it won a Good Food Awards this year, and I got some help from Robert Aguilera at Fromagex in sourcing recipes for that, and we came up with one that we could age. It's sold a bit younger, I believe, in France, and so that's part of why we can't get it here. And so we came up with a way to make it and age it and take a little more time and get it to 60 days.
Didn't
and
you have
that's,
to build
that's
it?
That's moving out pretty well.
Didn't and, you have to
And
build?
Then, so they have both those, the Mirabella and the Adair are turning out to be our best-selling cheeses. But we also started making a Tome this year just to try that. And we have a county with a French name, so we could be Tome de Fayette.
Very clever.
I said, that's where you are in Indiana, Fayette County, huh?
And we make that Brianna with truffles in it.
Wow.
And then we make a little mold-ripened soft thing called JQ, which is named after my great-grandfather, John Quincy Elliott. And then we also make a feta. And so we're trying all those different things. If I had my way, I would just make Everton all day long.
Yeah.
I love to make Everton, and it's my favorite of all those cheeses. But we have to do what selling, and we're a young company, so we're still finding out what works. So.
Well, do you have to build all these facilities for Affin Lounge and so forth?
We do our own. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, you had to build things and add to your farm. It must have been an expensive proposition to redevelop the farm as a cheese-making operation.
Well, actually, I mean, I built, a friend of mine helped me, and I worked with Neville McNaughton to design my place, and he did a really good job for us, and I think about how my neighbor grain farmers who have a combine that, you know, just the combine without the grain heads or anything like that, they've got, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 invested in that. And so I'm in that neighborhood, and they only use their combine for a few weeks out of the year, but I use mine most of the year round to convert milk into cheese. So as far as farming investments go, it's not that out of line, actually.
Now, you have an unusual milking parlor, I think. Am I calling it the right thing?
It's a New Zealand Swing 16 style.
I never even heard of a New Zealand Swing 16.
Tell us about it.
How is it different?
Well, it was developed in New Zealand, and it's a high throughput type parlor, and the New Zealanders dairy industry is based on milking a lot of cows cheaply, and they had, you know, in the grass because grain was difficult to source for them, and so it's not real high tech as far as electronics are concerned, but it's very well designed for cow throughput, and we can milk two people can milk like 120 cows an hour through it. I used to milk more cows when I was still shipping to the co-op, and I used to have 240 cows. We're just milking 80 now.
Oh, really?
Jeez, but it was the first one built in the state of Indiana, and so we had I got a little taste of dealing with the regulators on that one, and that was a good experience for when we started our cheese plant. So
you're making a delightful hard cheeses, and I love the soft cheeses you're making. There's one area that's missing, which is blue cheese. Will you ever venture into blue cheese, do you think?
Yes, probably. I'm thinking about it. I don't know when. There's a couple others I want to do as well. So I'm kicking those around, but launching too many at once is a problem. I mean, when I started, I just wanted to do two or three cheeses and do them well and sell everything I make, and everything was going to be wonderful. But it doesn't quite work out that way, so I have to, you know, try and find different things to sell. And you know, and also part of it's just taking time to develop our market and people. We are a new company, so it takes people time to, you know, decide that they want to go with you. And fortunately, we're seeing a lot of movement in that direction. So
there's a neat little. It seems like to me like there's a, with all of course my great knowledge of cheese, but there is a little bit of a sweet spot for someone who's interested in making all raw milk cheeses, which is the. Which is the raw milk replacement for Stilton, which has now been totally bastardized and is made almost like a manufacturing industry. But there's somebody who's making a cheese called Stitchleton.
Yeah, Stitchleton.
Which is cows from the same area, but it's a raw milk version. So it's the old Stilton recipe.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And it seems like that might be.
That's one of my favorite cheeses too. So
Peter's
English. Of favorites, I've seen videos of them making Stilton, and that's a lot of work.
I don't know how they make it. I mean,
it's a lot of work to take care of it.
It's a lot of work.
What about those Rogue Creamery guys? The old Italian guy that founded the Rogue Creamery, he mm-hmm. actually smuggled the bacteria out of Roquefort. He did. I mean, it's a known fact.
We can say that now since he's dead.
He's dead, yeah.
Statute of limitations has expired.
Yeah, exactly. But that's Yeah, but that's not what he did. He just, you know, he was in the caves and he brought the, bacteria.
Yeah, that's a, it's a little different climate now, I think, for that kind of thing. Yeah.
I think so. Well, this, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. It has been almost as much of a pleasure as it was eating your cheese.
Yeah.
Pretty soon we're going to be pining for it because the last piece is about to be opened. In fact, I was going to open it. I was going to open it before I came up to the sound studio, but I didn't have time.
We're available nationwide and online too.
Yeah. Now tell us about that. Tell us that you ship all across the United States.
We do. You're usually, you know, shipping is high price for cheese, so you're usually better off to, if you can find it in your area, you'll be better off. But we're at jnbcheese.com, but we are all over the country, so most well-stocked cheesemongers can get us if they don't already have it. So
you need to ask for it. It's called J&B. So if you're a local supermarket or your local
Jacobs in Bridgeford.
Jacobs and Bridgeford. Mm-hmm. Bridgeford is the you want to get them to stock that because it's really terrific stuff, listeners. Believe me, we've eaten 3 pounds of cheese between the two of us in 2 weeks.
Well, it's raw milk cheese, so it's good for you.
There we go.
I'm sure it's good for you.
I'm so glad it's good for us, it's a lovely story. A story with a happy ending in agriculture is always a good story to have.
That's for sure.
So Matthew, we thank you for telling us the story, and we wish the best to you and your family and your entire Jacobs Bridgeford team.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Let us know when you make a new cheeses.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, if we told you our next guest was from Vermont, you'd probably guess that we're still on the cheese track. But it happens that although Vermont, in fact, produces some of the very best cheeses in the United States, in fact, some of the very best cheeses in the world, the subject of this conversation with people from Vermont is all about bitters.
I guess
we better just let Guido explain it because it's really complicated. In the past, we've had a number of conversations about the subject of today's interview, which is bitters, but it's always been in the context of bitters as used in cocktails, and of course the very first one everybody claims being credited to New Orleans because Dr. Peychaud, or Dr. Peychaud, however it's pronounced, was making a fortune using his bitters to flavor unsatisfactorily flavored spirits and inventing a cocktail originally called the Sazerac. Now, that's a little bit of ancient history and a very small piece of history compared to a book which landed on our desk a few weeks ago, which is called
DIY Bitters, Reviving the Forgotten Flavor, A Guide to Making Your Own Bitters.
And one of the authors, Guido Marseille, originally Italian, now resident in Vermont, and
Jovial King, who we've had on our show before, representing his company, Urban Moonshine. Their company, they're partners in Urban Moonshine.
But I never knew there was so much to it, Guido. It's just hard to believe the amount of information that you've gathered together. First of all, how did you do that and why?
Yeah, I mean, I come to bitters and to the cocktail world as an herbalist. So as a person who spends his time looking and foraging for plants in the forest or in the field and really studying about their history, their traditional uses, and all of the crazy amount of modern research that is around medicinal plants and medicinal herbs. And I also work in clinics, so I help folks kind of figure out which ones of those plants might be useful in their life, and I get to kind of monitor their progress while they're drinking these teas or consuming these extracts. So I was sort of steeped in, you know, from when I was a little kid in the Alps.
Yeah, tell us about that.
In this herbal material, exactly. And so, you know, when you sell herbal extracts at farmers market, people come around and they say, like, oh, this is very interesting. What do you got here? Wow, is this witchcraft? What's going on? And then they come to the bottle of bitters, and they say, like, oh, like you said, in my Sazerac, or in my Old Fashioned, or in my Martini, is that what you mean by bitters? And we say, yes. But do you know that these plants that are in here also have this 1,000-year, 2,000-year, 3,000-year history with human beings, and they've got this crazy chemistry that is responsible for the flavor that you experience when you taste digestive bitters, and that chemistry then has medicinal benefits. And so we joke around and we say, like, you know, the plants and the formulas and the recipes that we talk about in DIY bitters are great for the bar, and they're great for the do-it-yourselfer at home, really wanting to dazzle their dinner party guests with something really unique. But we might be able to get a conversation started about the history and the medicinal benefits of regularly consuming these plants, too. And it's funny that it might start through the cocktail, but it doesn't have to just be a cocktail. You can use bitters in sparkling water. You can use them on your own, or you can use them even in preparations that don't involve alcohol, like the bitter pastilles we talk about in DIY bitters.
But there's some basic chemistry behind this, which is itself is really deep. Can you sort of summarize what's involved and perhaps why these chemical things actually really work?
Yeah, I mean, the spectrum of chemistry in the plant world is almost infinite, especially when you start combining some of those chemicals. And most of the pharmaceuticals that we've used over the course of history have been plant-derived substances also. So it's really incredibly rich, as you say. But my point in the book is to get people to realize that the flavors you experience on your tongue and qualities like astringency in a mouthfeel, like that tannin effect from a young wine, all of those things reflect chemistry. We can detect these chemicals with our tongue in a really, really interesting way, and in a way that is very accurate and reproducible, actually. And part of that is because it makes sense evolutionarily for us to be able to get a sense of what is going to come down the pike once we consume a plant. And historically, particularly the bitter flavor and the chemicals like, you know, lactones or even milder bitter-tasting chemicals like bioflavonoids that we find in the plant world, could have been an initial signal for something that is one of the most bitter plant constituents that we know of, which is the alkaloid. So strong alkaloids like atropine and strychnine, which are deadly poisons, are sort of warning signs and indicators to the body to be careful, to ramp up detoxification machinery in the liver, to really increase digestive secretions, to make sure that everything we're consuming is completely broken down and therefore less hazardous to the body. Now, on a smaller and gentler way, chemicals that we use in traditional digestive bitters, like from gentian root or artichoke leaf, aren't toxic, but stimulate and trigger those same protective reflexes from the body. And so you get this really sort of waking up and enlivening. You detect it first with your tongue, with increased salivary production in the mouth, and then that's echoed all throughout the GI tract. So this chemistry is really fantastic at waking up the digestion and improving the function of the liver.
So that's what that's the bit that's that it's all about. So it's stimulation of the liver and other things to do with digestion, which is why they have the value that they have.
That's traditionally what we've seen people use digestive bitters for, right? And so when I go back to Italy and have an amaro at the end of a meal, we're leveraging that sort of digestive quality that you see from these bitter-tasting plants. Yeah. And there's this whole other range of, like, the flavoring plants, which are the second leg of the stool of a good traditional bitters formula, right? Whether it be citrus peel or fennel seed or anise, lemon balm, citrus peel, or even something like pine, something more creative along those lines, all of those tend to relax the gut and decrease sort of feelings of spasm or bloating or just discomfort and indigestion associated with meals. So the bitter is the first leg, right? The flavoring, the aromatic, spicy, enlivening components are the second, and they're the ones that are more relaxing and soothing to the
gut musculature. And then the third leg of most traditional classic bitter preparations is either something sweet or something starchy to kind of improve the mouthfeel, make the formula a little more round and rough and smooth out the rough edges to make it more palatable and more enjoyable at the end of a meal. But really that's where it's at, digestive function. And we go a little further in DIY bitters because plants have a range of other benefits as well, whether they are sort of supportive to the cardiovascular system or they can also be supportive and modulating to the immune system. So we talk about some other ideas to go kind of beyond the bread and butter of traditional bitters, which is digestion.
Now, you're not just researching this. You're actually using it in a medical setting, right?
Well, herbalists are, we call ourselves educators. So essentially, when folks come to my clinic and we sit down one-on-one, we're getting into a conversation about what their goals might be and what some of the clinical research, pharmacological research, and traditional uses around plants are, and how to make those plants and those goals sort of match up. And then, you know, we talk later about how people are feeling and what they think of those plants and how they've been working in their life. And so I get to see kind of firsthand that these botanicals really do have discrete, measurable effects, and that they help people feel more well, more resilient, more engaged in life. And the absolute favorite thing for me is to see them then take that to their dining room table or plant a mint or a lemon balm plant in their garden that then they'll use to make their own extracts. And let's bring that full circle then, you know, to a cocktail party with friends or to a dinner party with friends and really start seeing the reintroduction of herbal medicine as a practice into daily life. And I think that's the biggest reason why we were spurred to write this book is to really share our joy around the incredible power of these medicinal plants, how they can really make a difference in people's lives, and how fun they are to use on a daily basis around the dinner table.
But you're only a certain distance into this, right? So there's more work that needs to be done?
Well, I think there certainly could be more work done in terms of bringing more medicinal plants into daily life. But I think if you start just coming up with one or two formulas from this book that really work for you and that you like the flavor of, you will begin to see benefits in your life. And then that begins to shift the conversation a little bit, you know, from one of waiting for problems and then hitting them with hard drugs to trying to support your body as if you were a gardener, bringing compost and nutrition and a different range of enlivening plants into your life on a daily basis. So, yes, compared to the Italian culture, medicinal plants get short shrift in the modern American culture. But one way for them to get back in that is fun and that is accessible and that is easy to do is to start doing it at the dining room table with things like digestive bitters.
Now, what does the medical profession think of all this?
I mean, that's a good question. When I was starting my practice, and this was, you know, 2000, 2001, I would say that most of the physicians with whom I spoke were skeptical at best and hostile in many other situations. Now that we've seen more clinical research and studies where they've actually used placebos to compare medicinal plants and see what they can do in the human system, and we have these really good results for things like cardiovascular health and inflammation and immune function and digestive function, doctors are really coming around, and especially the new generation of folks that are coming out of medical school are much more interested in meeting their patients where they're at through combination of nutrition and herbs and things like meditation and yoga and a just more comprehensive, supportive approach for people on a daily basis. Still, you know, so I work with physicians now and we refer folks back and forth. For example, oncologists with whom I collaborate will send people for nutritional advice and advice on sort of keeping their immune system strong while they're undergoing chemotherapy.
Sure.
Firstly, I'll send folks to physicians all the time when I feel like they really need treatment that is a little stronger than what herbs might be able to provide, or if I need good diagnostic testing done because we just really don't know what's going on. I'm not a diagnostician. Physicians are so good at that. But I'm a great sort of gardener of the human insides.
Yeah, I can that's
bring
a great way of putting it.
In that really help people feel better and stronger.
You know, I just recently experienced this changeover in doctors. I fell and broke my nose, and I bruise very easily, and so I had all this bruising. And my pharmacist said to try, is it arnica?
An arnica gel or an arnica oil.
Well, this was actually a pellet
you sucked on. Little pills under the only problem was
being old and not very dexterous, we tended to lose the little pills.
but that's homeopathy, right?
Yeah, it's homeopathy.
And homeopathy is an entirely different discipline from herbal medicine. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that a while ago, a mainstream doctor would really turn his nose up. And when you mentioned it, and I went to a regular doctor, I mean, mainstream, and I told him that I was taking this, and he said, well, that's fine. I think that we even had alternative medicine clinics set up at the local hospital, except that somebody got out of line and did one of these sweat tents that killed somebody. So I think they kind of wiped that out. Yeah, I know. But now I'm saying, I think in general, that we're having more a New Age now than we had in so-called New Age period.
Well, I definitely think people are more open-minded. And again, because they really want whatever it is that's going to help, you know, your nose feel a little better and that bruising dissipate more quickly, rather than trying to hold any type of ideology above
right,
the well-being
exactly.
of the people we work with.
You know, I don't understand, Guido, how nature is sending us mixed signals. It used to be, if it was bitter, avoid it. And that's why you've had bitter. And
mm-hmm.
But you're saying now that bitter, but you get past it. I mean, it's a mixed signal.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that there's a continuum. It's not bitter or not bitter. There's very violently strong, bitter-tasting things that we react to very strongly. And then there's some milder tasting bitters as well. And that's part of what we try and articulate in the book, and also talk about the science of formulating bitters so that they're not being taken all by themselves. Yes, a little bit of the bitter flavor is great, but if you just take wormwood tincture by itself or gentian root tincture by itself, this really strong bitter, it's disgusting. It's not going to do you any good in the long term. It needs to be balanced by those aromatic enlivening constituents, and then balanced by that sort of sweetness to kind of round out the rough edges. And when you do that, then you can enjoy a little bit of the hair of the dog, so to speak. You know, it's not poison. It's not going to kill you the way belladonna or strychnine might, which taste incredibly bitter and are revolting. But a little bit of engagement of that bitter flavor will wake up your own digestive and detoxification machinery. And ultimately, historically, even if we were to find a root in the ground to eat for food, we would have had to navigate bitter fiber and bitter bark and constituents that the plants produce, ultimately as protection against insects and rodents primarily, right?
Yeah.
And we would have had to work with that and detoxify it in order to get the nutrition of the plant material. So a digestive system really evolved in the context of consuming a continuum of bitter-tasting things, some that are outrightly toxic that we would probably reject immediately and spit out, and others that were more mildly bitter that we learned to live with, and now it's becoming increasingly obvious we cannot live without if we want our digestive system and mostly our appetite, right, and our relationship to sugar to be more balanced and more sustainable. We really need that bitterness in there, too.
You said the most bitter thing was part of the study you did where you fed people the ends of artichoke leaves.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been pretty... That's an example of your fibrous protection system, huh?
Yeah, and like eating just artichoke leaves by themselves, you'd have a really hard time doing it.
Yeah.
But you mix that with a little citrus and fenugreek and you make it maybe 10% of the formula, it totally works fine, and it still is enough to kind of wake everything up in the gut without being overwhelmingly nasty.
Yeah,
well, now, one of the things you've got in this book is a laundry list. It's not fair to call it a laundry list. A list of all the botanicals, if we can call them that, that are part of your toolkit.
Yes.
And
there's about 100 different substances. And we go into detailed sort of extraction and chemistry and flavor and folklore around all of those plants. So we're really encouraging people. I know there are some DIY bitters kits where you put all the herbs together in a jar and then you pour vodka over them and let them sit for a month or so. And that's fine. That works pretty well. But if you really want to give each plant its sort of deserved spotlight on the stage of a well-crafted bitters formula, you really should extract each one individually, because they rely on different concentrations of ethanol for maximum sort of punch and extraction of their flavorful chemistry. And some have to steep for a little longer, some have to steep for a shorter period of time. If you overbrew Peruvian bark or cinchona, the source of quinine, it gets muddy and astringent and nasty. But if you really just steep it for one day or a day and a half, you get this clean quinine bitter that is really, really useful. And then it really increases the customization options, because if you have 15 bottles of individual botanicals, you can add, you know, 10% of one for your first formula try, and then you could go up to 15 if you wanted a little more bitterness, or up to 20 on the orange peel if you wanted a little more of that sort of citrusy aromatic quality to it. So you can take our basic recipe templates, and if you've extracted each individually, each plant individually, you can then customize them yourself, and you can bring that to the table, and you've got a story that is based on flavor, a story that is based on chemistry and potential medicinal benefits, and a story that is based on, like, maybe you grew one of these plants, or you harvested it yourself on a trip to the southwestern desert where there's this amazing sagebrush that just has this super unique camphory smell and flavor. And you can lay that on the table and have this amazing conversation starter. You can experience health benefits, and you can bring people together around a whole food meal, which ultimately is my main mission in life.
Now, you have some rather interesting characters that you introduce in that latter part of the book too. People that you've met along the way, so, some of them with some very interesting names. There's one which is several short words, and I think the last one is dog.
So we interviewed five of our sort of favorite herbalists and people who have experience using bitters from a culinary but also a medicinal perspective. And that woman you referenced, Dr. Tirona Lowdog, she not only is a Native American extraction and tradition, but she was also on Bill Clinton's White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine. She was one of the founders of the Integrative Medicine Fellowships at the University of Arizona. And she's been a physician and herbalist that has practiced, you know, in the Southwest and spoken at herbal conferences and physician conferences for many years. So she's really one of our sort of wise elders and leaders in the herbal community. And bitters are one of her most favorite things and go-to things. But we really liked adding the perspective of people who, like you were saying, using these plants on a daily basis in people's lives and seeing what they can do for folks. And all of the herbalists we interviewed have a lot of experience doing that.
Well, it seemed to me it's a good place to start this book, but I mean, it's an awful lot to learn.
Well, you know, I'm not done learning by any means, and that's one of the reasons I like this so much. You know, you can, once you get to know even a few of these plants, then taking a stroll in a park or in the woods or even in an urban environment becomes a whole different experience. It's like you unlock these gates to a hidden green world, and these guys become your allies, even if only in terms of flavor. You think of yourself as sort of a forager now all of a sudden, and you'll harvest a little bit of this bark or a little bit of these leaves, and you can bring it home and do a little bit of extraction and begin to play with it. And the more you do that, the more you'll learn. And in this book, we certainly have given a great sort of jumping off point from chemistry, physiologic benefits, folklore, history of all these plants. But our hope is that you'll take that and get as excited as we are about it and use that as a jumping off point for your own lifetime study of not just digestive bitters and flavor combination, but also just the richness of working with this, with these other living beings that are all around us and that are really an inherent part of human evolutionary history and human cultural history, too.
You know, I'm looking at this photo of you and Jovial, and you both look so happy, and you're in sunshine. You must have not been in Vermont, right?
And there was
no, you know, we took a lot of those photos right in Burlington, Vermont. And it was a beautiful late summer sunny day. And Vermont's an amazing place in summer.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you, if you can get over the 20 below winter nights, Vermont's a great place to be.
Yeah. Well, your enthusiasm is just amazing. Listeners, I think you'll agree that you'll come back to this topic to follow and as your guide along the way, DIY bitters. Is the book to have. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and please give our regards to your colleague. What's her name?
I will indeed, and thank you guys as well. I'll let Jovial know.
Okay.
And I hope you enjoy the book as much as we enjoyed putting it together.
Oh, it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I do. Anyhow, I'm off to munch on my turmeric, which I've been ingesting like crazy. I heard how good some of these things are. But I just think it's a whole new horizon for us. And thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to hear it.
So there you have it. Until next week, we'll wish you a happy birthday now. Since
happy birthday.
Yeah, no, I mean Merry Christmas. We'll wish you Merry Christmas now.
Well, we can wish Adam a happy birthday.
Yeah, we can do that too, because he's during the week. But I want to get it in early, because a lot of you will be listening to this program perhaps before it's even Christmas Day. But we promise you we'll have a new program then, just as we did this week, and we hope that in the meantime you'll have a Merry Christmas.
And Happy Hanukkah, which is the same day this year.
Isn't that remarkable? And
that means a lot of partying, huh?
More remarkable is we still have a lot to say for ourselves after over an hour. So I think it's time to say goodbye.
Bye-bye.